And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Harvey Kubernick with us. Harvey, the Rolling Stones, they just keep rolling along, don't they?
Well, why not?
Exactly. I mean, how old are they now? How old is Mick Jagger?
He's 78.
Good for them. And he's still got as much energy as he had when he was 30.
More than ever. The older you get, sometimes... If it isn't the better you get, maybe it's the more determined. It's something Ice-T told me, the rapper actor. He said, it's not about being the man, it's about staying the man.
That is pretty true, too. It's endurance. It's all about endurance.
Yes.
You've looked at some theme songs, too. You're a Twilight Zone aficionado, aren't you?
I wish I could have gotten a PhD in Twilight Zone if they had the course at a school that accredited it. Twilight Zone made a big impact on me, and I'm asked about it because I thank Rod Serling in my books, and I sort of saw him one time. But I was living in Culver City, California, in this 1959-63 world where Twilight Zone was sort of filmed in the neighborhood, part of MGM Studio.
Yeah.
And so, it's sort of like buildings and the police station and the schoolhouse, things that were, near our swimming pool and all that, you would see, and I'm seeing this at age 8, 9, 10, and 11, and listen, as a fan of your show, Rod Serling sort of was, I don't think the term opening act is appropriate, he sort of was the door opener about the solar system, paranormal visitors, aliens, however you want to call it. He showed us the possibility in a world coming out of, the Korean War and things like that, that when we were dealing with concepts of Roswell, New Mexico and all that, Rod Serling at least gave a microscope of that window.
Oh, that's so true. Do you know Mark Zegree by any chance?
I have a signed book from Mark Zegree from 30 years ago who wrote The Twilight Zone Companion.
Exactly. Great guy. Great guy.
That's an authority.
Yes, he knows The Twilight Zone. But that theme song, who wrote that?
I don't think it was Jerry Goldsmith. It was probably somebody affiliated with the studio at the time, and it didn't have any vocals on it. But it was such a gripping tension. It brought you into the unexpected.
So catchy.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
When you heard that theme song, you knew a nice, strange, mystical show was coming on.
Besides that, this wasn't a Scream movie and terror and shrieking horror that you were going to experience. It was the human condition was sort of on parade, and you knew there would be betrayal, there'd be companionship, there'd be various agendas of people, there'd be distrust on display. It just was, I don't know. I'm asked about The Twilight Zone a lot because, I mean, how many people write books and thank The Twilight Zone or mention, the Cannamits from an episode. But if I'm at a book signing or in a record store or in a restaurant or something or in a market, some guy or some woman will come up to me and said, I have one of your books. I have it in the car. Can you stay here? But then they'll go, I want you to know my mother worked on a Twilight Zone episode. And it turns into an hour discussion about season 3 of Twilight Zone.
I love it. Who were some of the top female singers of the 60s?
From Britain, Petula Clark, Lulu, Sandy Shaw, Dionne Warwick, Mary Wells, and of course, the Phil Spector produced girl groups, the Ronettes, the Crystals. They all just delivered, and they were the soundtracks of our lives because... Now, they weren't really writing their own material at the time, like a lot of women today are really in control of their careers, playing, singing, writing, and producing. They were not really puppets for the producers and the record labels. They were performers and singers, and they really weren't super active in the songwriting aspect of the pop and rock experience. But vocally, you turned the radio up when you heard these songs.
Sure did. Let's go to the calls. West of the Rockies, Mark's with us in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call, and great show. I always love the music shows, George.
Thank you. Me too. They're fun.
Hello, Mark.
Harvey, great. Everything you're talking about resonates with me. I grew up in Los Angeles, Southern California area in the 60s and 70s, and have been playing music since I was a little kid, so my DNA is completely saturated with all this stuff. And I was a big fan of the Monkees when I was a little kid, and then I became a session player in the 80s and was called to play on the Monkees' comeback record.
Wow.
And what I wanted to get your thought was the producer and the session players, we were all excited that the 60s were coming back, and we were going to get to, you know, kind of play the music and the sounds that the Wrecking Crew played and everything, and the Monkees showed up, and they wanted to sound 80s. And that debate of whether they should have been 80s or 60s, it goes on today on the Monkees fan pages, and I wanted to know what you thought of that, or if you've ever heard that record, Pull It.
I have, and I don't know if the word dilemma is the appropriate term. Often you have a choice when you are a classic rock or a heritage act, we'll call. You either give the audience what they want or demand and you retreat and recreate or live in the world that you came out of, or you have this, if not obsession, this determination to be current and modern and hip and not be trapped by your past, shall we say, sonic, fingerprints. And that extends to so many people. Do you want to continue? Here you are at 60 years old. Do you want to be the person you were at 23 to satisfy the musicians or an audience? Or do you want to try to move forward? And, I just wrote a 12,000-word Hollywood memoir piece about the Monkees, and it didn't even address the current record that you played on and know about. It was my interview with Mickey Dolenz from 2014. And people, and look at the recent tours, when you go to a concert of the Monkees or a lot of these, the classic rock or heritage acts, as they're called, and people are paying big bucks for this too. You want to hear and see and feel the original music, from the arrangements to maybe the close vocal aspects of it. And sometimes it creates a dilemma. And for somebody like you, that was participated in the new journey of the Monkees. It must have been, if not troubling, a little bit puzzling for you.
What happened to groups like Freddie and the Dreamers and those kind of people?
Well, I know Freddie died many years ago, and he was in the original English Invasion, and he was a little older than everybody coming out of TV and radio of the 50s in England. But there were a few tunes, whether it be I'm Telling You Now and Do the Freddie. It was pretty wacky. Music. I always kind of thought Freddie was sort of like our version. We got to hear him. He reminded us of Soupy Sales, who came out of Detroit.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and there's always room for everything in the pop bandwidth.
What's amazing to me too, Harvey, is the chronology of how these groups are. I mean, in the 50s, we had Sinatra, Dean Martin, Louis Prima, those people, Keeley Smith. Then we kind of migrated to other groups like the Beatles and Elvis, Wayne Newton, and it just keeps changing. You know, societies change.
Well, what happened, in the 40s and 50s and the first part of the 60s, the people performing and singing and recording, for the most part, didn't write their own material.
Correct.
So once the Beatles showed up, who wrote their own songs after covering a lot of earlier artists, naturally, you're going to have people are going to start to chronicle and capture and document their world, which sometimes extends to our world. And so there's going to be that evolution that happens right there, and that just keeps building.
What about the groups that had like a one-hit wonder, but they were great songs, like the Buckinghams, you know?
Like Don't You Care and Susan. Well, they had a handful of great tunes, and those are beautiful, well-produced records, and they were part of bringing us the music of the pop rock music of Chicago, which kind of, brings us the group Chicago, but the Buckinghams helped lay the foundation of the music of Chicago and Illinois that was not the blues and jazz sounds coming from, you know, the Chess Records or the VJ Records or the Brunswick record label.
The Vogues, I love them. You're the One.
Oh, my
great
God,
song.
5 o'clock World. Again, I ask anybody to play You're the One or 5 o'clock World. Put that on headphones.
It's great.
And take a listen to the vocal harmonies and the arrangements on those records. You did have, again, that's a situation where I don't think they really wrote their songs. They were singers. They accepted their role as recording artists, and other people were involved in the sonic dynamic, arrangers, session players. But the songs are impeccable, and when I talk to students and people, I say, put it on in headphones, since you're not really listening to AM radio on your car radio anymore. It the things really pop. They go deep into your eardrums.
Big time. Harvey, we've got a text or tweet from Tom. What do you have for us, Tommy?
Harvey, this one in from Jason in Phoenix. Please talk about Deals with the Devil and Backwards Masking in music by artists such as Led Zeppelin and the great Robert Johnson.
You know, that is one topic, and I'm not being evasive of it. I didn't really buy too much of that. I do know there's great folklore, and maybe it's been proven, and it's been well documented about Deals with the Devil, of putting your soul on the line for some kind of career success. But I just, when I think about the Led Zeppelin or Judas Priest or some of these lawsuits or legal things, or just media creations, or shall we say the preoccupation of some journalists and the coverage that was global about taping backward masking and secret messages and all that, I never could grasp it, because groups like Led Zeppelin and Jimmy Page were also at the same time were simultaneously drawing from the past, but they were creating the future.
Big time, big time. We've got Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Welcome to the show. Hi, Frank.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. 60s. I was brought up in the 60s. It's my favorite music genre. I want to ask Harvey a question about the late Rick Nelson and Elvis. They didn't seem to like each other, but the late James Burton, what a guitarist he was.
He played
for Elvis, and he played for Rick Nelson. But I want to know, Harvey, the chronology. And the Jordanaires, Elvis backup singers, they also sang backup for Rick Nelson. Now, will you help me with the chronology of who worked for who first?
Well, first of all, there was a moment where Colonel Parker was considering managing Ricky Nelson.
Ah.
So let's put that on the table. And Ricky Nelson and Elvis did meet when Elvis came to town. They were not in competition. They often used some of the same musicians on their records, i.e. James Burton, who played on stage with Elvis and was in Ricky Nelson's TV show band and played on records. And it's funny, but that when Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin first came to Hollywood before Led Zeppelin, he was trying to put the new band together after the Yardbirds, he came to the record label Liberty Records, and he wanted to meet James Burton. And because the Ricky Nelson records made such an impression on him, and of course, I was at one Elvis Presley concert, and Robert Plant and Jimmy Page were there, and they were escorted backstage to meet Elvis. But the they were all in the same business together, Ricky Nelson and Elvis Presley. It was a smaller, almost fraternity back then. There were a handful of record labels, and they knew the same agent, sometimes William Morris. They often had the same legal representation. So the chronology is they were very tight at the hip. They were not warring factions or anything.
Glenn Campbell was a guitar player for groups, wasn't he, in the beginning?
Glenn Campbell is on Monkees albums. Glenn Campbell's on Elvis Presley sessions. He's on Wouldn't It Be Nice with Barney Kessel on the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album selection. Nobody really knew Glenn was a singer when he first came from New Mexico. And he was a great golfer and a great session player. And all of a sudden, he hooked up with people like the record producer Nick Vinay at Capitol Records, and later the arranger producer Al DeLore. And then, of course, the song is often the key. And when you find Jimmy Webb material, like By the Time I Get to Phoenix, that's the evidence.
It sure is. Joe in the Bronx, take it away, Joseph.
Hey, George, how are you?
Oh, good.
Great. Harvey, I wanted to ask you about your critique of the Rascals, but David Brigati is a friend of mine. And also, if you could lend a little opinion of Joey D and the Starlighters, because the Beatles early on opened for Joey D and the Starlighters in Sweden. Also, if you could touch a little bit on Sid Bernstein, who managed the Rascals.
Okay, well, last week I published an interview with Felix Cavalieri of the Rascals that I conducted in 2013, because he's going out with Mickey Dolenz, the voice of the Monkees, on a tour this year.
How about that?
That's part of the answer. Love Joey D and the Starlighters, Peppermint Twist. I love them when they were in some of those early rock and roll black and white movies. Gene Cornish of the Rascals came out of there with the members of the Rascals. And as far as Sid Bernstein, he brought the Beatles to the concert stage in New York. He has an autobiography out. That was an agent that really either mortgaged his house or worked very hard believing in the Beatles when they first came to America and other groups. And there were a lot of people that helped pave the foundation for all these big music festivals and this current century of live attraction. But, you know, somebody like me is aware of the components of the management, the agent, and the Rascals. I can't tell you. They had an affinity, by the way, to Los Angeles. They did music videos here in the 60s. They were on a lot of the Hollywood shows. They were so New York. We were sunshine LA people. We got a taste of real New York. But then I tell everybody, well, the song Good Lovin' was done by an LA group first called the Olympics. So, you know, put that in your pipe.
Harvey, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Connie Willis in. So she jump on board. She's got John Gray coming in. Men are from Mars. Women are from Venus. It's going to be a great program. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with our final segment with Harvey Kubernick as we talk about music in the 60s, his books, Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child. Tell me about that subtitle to that book, Harvey.
Well, it's actually... Jimi Hendrix actually had a song called Voodoo Child.
Uh-huh.
And an album, and it was actually a recording, and it seemed appropriate. It was a title actually selected by our publisher. I wrote the book with my brother Kenneth, and you could think of 1,000 titles of Jimi Hendrix. What do you even do for the subtitle? You see the word Jimi Hendrix, and you immediately push go.
Absolutely. What about Tom Jones, who started in the late 60s?
He actually a friend of Russ Reagan. Russ Regan was Tom Jones's promotional man when Tom Jones first came to the America, when he had the hits like It's Not Unusual and What's New Pussycat. And still active today, still recording, still performing after age 80, and a big fan of Motown, and also a close friend of Elvis Presley.
Really? Yeah, the Presley death was a shocker, wasn't it?
It was a shocker, and, you know, it's something, it's not about age 42. If you, you know, you think about, it's the first time, you know, maybe you think about things like diet or hypertension or stress of touring. And the last year of Elvis's life, I think he played 118 shows, the most he had ever done.
Wow.
And so at age 40, he's working more than ever. He's getting paid handsomely. But, you know, Elvis Presley leaving us in the physical then is something that we were not prepared for. And I know the focus is on the death. It's sort of like John F. Kennedy. You know the day he died, but how many of us know the day he was born?
That's right. That's a good point. There were more rumors that Colonel Parker may have done him in to take advantage of the money after the fact.
No, I would never subscribe to that.
Me either. Me either.
I've met many of the people in his entourage and involved with him, you know, very intimately. In fact, the term Lieber, the songwriting team, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, that wrote a lot of the early hits, you know, that were involved with the Jailhouse Rock. Mike Stoller told me one of the good things that Colonel Parker did for Elvis is he allowed him to travel with an entourage of friends. The Colonel was too busy creating publicity and promoting the next show or the next event or getting the next revenue stream. He wasn't one of these guys that was monitoring his talent, living with him or checking in 10 times a day. This is a world pre-cell phones and all that. So Elvis did what Elvis wanted to do. And, a tragic loss for all of us. But the recordings just sound marvelous.
Was he out of control physically?
I think as far as diets and the well-documented use of pills, and things like that, I personally think it must have been boring to do kind of the same one-hour show every night, sometimes twice a night when you're playing places like Las Vegas, the same songs. He really wasn't a songwriter. I think he co-wrote one song, maybe Heartbreak Hotel. Maybe Sinatra wrote maybe 8 songs, maybe. So you become a performing puppet. Some people crave it and enjoy it. I'm sure he did, but he didn't get a chance to grow and expand. That's why that 68 comeback special was a rebirthing for him, and I encourage people to check it out. But it's going to play havoc on you psychologically and emotionally when you're a vibrant recording artist with one of the best voices ever, and you are stuck in these societal bonds, maybe, that you're obligated to do the same 12 songs every night or tell the same jokes, wear the same wardrobe. It could be fatiguing.
What's amazing, too, last week he would have been 87 had he still been alive. 87 years old.
And Jerry Lee Lewis is still with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would you say the best artist has ever been all time? Sinatra?
You know, as an artist and the biggest body of work, all fingers point to Frank Sinatra. The ups and downs, the movie career, the television career, the record label owning career. You know, there are those factors besides just somebody singing and recording. And I saw him in concert, I don't know, a half a dozen times. I recently interviewed Nancy Sinatra. And, I've been on a Sinatra kick lately.
Me too.
Dick Clark and I once discussed Sinatra, and I said, what was it about Frank? And he said, well, you know, he studied kind of what Tommy Dorsey was doing as far as the trombone and the phrasing techniques. Frank could sing a song, and you really thought he was singing it to you personally.
To you, that's right. And the words, he made the words happen.
Yes, and again, all roads point to Russ Reagan. He's the guy that brought Bat's Life to Frank Sinatra.
That's great. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Phil in Seattle, Washington to get us started. Hey, Philip, go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Okay, Phil, thanks.
Hey, I just want to tell you briefly, thank you for all you do for us out here. You are a lifeline
in
the pandemic of the real information that's really going on in the world, and especially on the holidays when we're alone and you're making sure you're broadcasting. Just thanks for everything, George. It's fantastic.
I really appreciate that, Phil. Thank you.
And briefly on the topic, I want to hit something on the late 60s and go back to the early 60s, and I'll be as brief as I can. I was fortunate enough to work at a music store in the Seattle area, and we had a Seattle Pop Festival here in 69, which was in Woodinville. And on the bill were all of the, you know, everybody, Santana, just the Led Zeppelin to the Doors. So the last day was the Doors and then Zeppelin. Well, Zeppelin pulled up with their van, and there was all their equipment. I got to sit with John Bonham, help him tune his drums, hand him his beers, chat about the music business. I was a drummer back then in the late 60s, and he was my drum god, and I was just unbelievably privileged to sit with a man. Jim Morrison was very stoned that day, and when he went on stage, he was flipping everybody off and using the F-bomb, and basically they booed him off, and the helicopter came and picked up the band, and then Zeppelin closed the show.
Wow.
So that was I've heard that show, and Robert Plant has talked about, I think he was disappointed. He was looking forward to seeing the Doors because I think he had seen them the year before in England, and it apparently wasn't a very good Doors concert at all.
How about Queen? When were they?
Oh, man, I interviewed Freddie Mercury of Queen. He was dynamic on stage. He was one of my favorite interview subjects.
Great,
he was charismatic, and he was such a great writer, and he was such a unique vocalist.
I will always remember the clip of him at the Live Aid. He captured that audience, didn't
he? Well, it was talk about seizing the moment. That was like a Gettysburg Address event.
Exactly. What did you think about the movie, Bohemian Rhapsody?
I liked a lot of it because I saw the group a few times. I interviewed the band members and Freddie, and it was a very pretty accurate, depiction. And the guy who played Freddie, Rami Malek, actually
did a great job.
He went to high school in Sherman Oaks at Notre Dame High School.
Really? I didn't know that.
And that kid really caught it, from the makeup to the wardrobe.
The teeth.
They had to put that in for the filming.
Yeah.
But he really brought us into the world of Freddie Mercury because when you see him in other shows, he's nothing like. That is called acting, and I kind of knew he would win the Academy Award for that.
Text and tweets, what do we have for Harvey, Tom?
Well, just talking about the Doors, this went in from Sherry in Wisconsin. Please discuss Jim Morrison and his role as a poet more than a singer.
Boy, you're talking to my sweet spot. And again, George, when your bumper music is Crystal Ship and you go into Steppenwolf, Born to Be Wild, thank you for reminding me. I took my driver's education class at Laurel Canyon. I have always recognized, I saw the Doors. Ray Manzarek was a dear friend. He's some of the Doors have been on.
We had Robbie Krieger.
You had Robbie and John on your show.
And Ray on the show, yeah.
And he was a mentor of mine. Jim Morrison is a poet. I'm not saying this differentiates me from some people who are music authors or in music journalism, but as early as 1972, when I was a student at San Diego State and had a class that I developed under a guy named Dr. James Wheeler in the literature department, who knew about the potency of rock lyricists and rock performers as poets. On the required reading assignments, we would put Jim Morrison's Lords and New Creatures book as required reading, and it was the first accredited upper division college course on rock literature. And we would study the lyrics, and Ray and Robbie wrote some lyrics too, but we viewed Jim as a poet. And when I saw The Doors live, he read some poetry to close the show, and his words were so well edited. He said so much in one line. I think people know he was a great, beautiful singer and a good band member, but the poetry, the words really hold up, whether it be Crystal Ship or you name them. There's so much more to Jim as a lyricist and a poet and a writer.
Great question. Joe, Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joseph.
Hi, Harvey. You know, Yoko Ono is actually going to be 89 February, yeah. And she was in Japan, in Tokyo, when we bombed the place, World War II. But I want to ask you about Hendrix, and I have a comment about the 60s. Hendrix apparently had a lot of stuff that he never released, and I'm wondering how that was gathered, because one of the posthumous albums was Cry of Love. And it's interesting that you mentioned Robert Plant, because I just heard a song on the radio from him with Alison Krauss, and just came out, and he sounds like clearer with his vocals and lower than he did with Led Zeppelin, almost like a different person. And also on the 60s, it seemed like it didn't define the era, the music, but it really was associated with the era, like breezy, airy, erudite. You know, you think of Peter, Paul, and Mary with Puff the Magic Dragon. You had Jefferson Airplane with Paul Kantner, just beautiful, beautiful songs. And then even Bob Marley, I believe, started in the 60s.
He did. The music continues. I know I said earlier people were singing for their supper, but it's so much deeper than that. It was a new frontier everybody collectively was exploring. And we now have the results, and we're grateful and thankful.
It's an amazing time period, to be sure. And how about the 70s? What were they like, Harvey?
Well, they were transitional. Again, in that thing you'd mentioned earlier about the 27 Club.
Yeah.
When you physically lose three guiding light spirits like Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, and Jimi Hendrix in that 1970-71 period, all of a sudden, maybe the quarterback, the tight end, and the fullback on your team are not on the playing field anymore. The game continues, and you have to have replacement players. But there were some great, great things that come out of the 70s, whether it be David Bowie or the country rock music that started developing. But the roots of the 70s stretch back to the 60s until you sort of get to the mid-70s or the later 70s, when you had punk rock and some of the new music that owed very little to the previous music. But then you realize, well, maybe the Clash liked Bo Diddley or they liked Elvis Presley, and they did have roots back to the earlier music. They sure just looked different than people before them.
They sure did. Harvey, we are out of time. Keep in touch with us. Love to have you back as a music source for us, okay?
You know where to find me, George. Thank you.
You take care.
It's a pleasure tonight.
Let's get together when I get back to L.A., okay?
To find me, I need to go to the Great Greek.
We'll do it. All right. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Morrows, Tim Benally, and Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.